The powers that be, how Lone Star State lawmakers are coming down on a resolution to limit the president's use of the military against Iran. Details today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Lots of private property blocking further border wall construction, but the Trump administration's found a way around it, and it's making conservationists upset. John Burnett previews his upcoming story for NPR. Also, how smart is a smart home if it can't help you conserve? A house in Junction, Texas, that could become a new model for the future. Plus, the week that was in Texas politics with the Texas Tribune and a whole lot more when the National News Show of Texas gets started. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 10th day of January 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Hope your weekend's getting off to a great start. Hey, it's Friday. Why wait? The House of Representatives sure isn't waiting for the next shoe to drop in the ongoing confrontation with Iran. Yesterday, by a vote of 224 to 194, the House passed a rebuke to President Trump over his use of the military, specifically vis-a-vis the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's what the resolution says. It, quote, directs the president to terminate the use of United States Armed Forces to engage in hostilities in or against Iran or any part of its government or military, close quote, unless Congress has declared war or specifically authorized engaging in hostilities, or if, again, to quote from the resolution, such use of the armed forces is necessary and appropriate to defend against an imminent armed attack upon the United States, close quote. Now, the measure goes to the Republican-led Senate, but if approved by both chambers, it would not require the president's signature because it is a concurrent resolution. This feature alone raising questions about whether this move is merely symbolic or legally binding. There are lots of other questions, too. For instance, in directing the president to terminate the use of the military against Iran, does that imply that we're already at war? Would this direct the president to pull out existing forces in the Persian Gulf? And how's the Texas delegation weighing in on all this? For more on all that, we're joined by Benjamin Wermund. He is Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Ben, welcome back to The Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Enjoyed your story this morning. So what exactly would this resolution do as you understand it?
I mean, as of now, it's basically a political move by House Democrats to try to prevent Trump from, put pressure on Trump, basically, to prevent him from moving further at all with Iran. As you said, it's a resolution. It's kind of non-binding, and it still has to go through the Senate. So as of now, it doesn't do a whole lot.
It's my understanding, though, that if the Senate were to approve it, and I suppose we should talk about the chances there, that this would be tied to the 1973 War Powers Act. Is that right, somehow or another?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, Democrats essentially are arguing that Trump has to get congressional authority to, or any president would have to get congressional authority to start a new war.
Under the Constitution, right, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, the administration believes they had the authority to take out the Iranian general that they did last week under authorization for the war on terror and the war in Iraq. That's kind of where the disagreement here is.
So how did Texans weigh in on this yesterday?
They were split, as you might imagine. Democrats all ended up voting for it, and Republicans all opposed it. You had a couple hours of debate where Texans were actually pretty vocal on the floor on this. You had some Republicans such as Will Hurd, who's a former CIA operative who worked in the Middle East, warning that this could be used as propaganda and urging his colleagues to vote against it. And Dan Crenshaw, another veteran, who said he took this personally and felt like it was kind of an insulting move to soldiers. But then you had Democrats who basically said it seems like they believe Trump acted recklessly with the strike last week, and they were worried that he might be putting more troops in harm's way. And essentially, they wanted a say in whether that happens or not.
Interesting. You write that House Republicans, including Representative Kevin Brady of Texas, calling this the Protect Terrorists Act. Has that gotten any traction there?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of become part of the Republican talking point against it. They've accused Democrats of mourning the loss of Soleimani more than, you know, Americans or whatever you want to say. Obviously, that's not exactly the case. It's not the case at all. They the resolution is very clear to condemn Soleimani and calls Iran a terrorist, a sponsor of state terrorism.
Right.
But well, yeah, I mean, obviously it's a political maneuver to try and make this look like more than just a silly move by Democrats, but an insulting one and something that's kind of unpatriotic.
But not all Republicans are on board with that. I mean, some Senate Republicans, Mike Lee, a Utah Republican, Rand Paul, a Kentucky Republican, they say that they did not like what they were hearing from the Trump administration when it comes to defense of the attack on this Iranian leader several days ago. What about John Cornyn and Ted Cruz? Have they weighed in on this?
Yeah, they've both lauded the move by Trump. They say it was a good thing to do. Cruz especially is very hawkish when it comes to Iran, so that's not surprising. I wouldn't expect either of them to support the Senate version of this, although it's sponsored by Tim Kaine, a Virginia Democrat, who's apparently making a pretty concerted effort to get some Republicans on board. I don't expect either of them will be joining it, although Cornyn did, you know, refer to it as a very serious matter, which is a little bit different in tone from some of the Republicans in the House who were calling it the Protect Terrorist Act.
And of course, this now moves on to the Senate. Benjamin Werman continues to follow this story as Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you.
New York billionaire and Democratic presidential candidate Michael Bloomberg is spending his weekend on a bus tour of Texas, hoping to meet with supporters and community leaders in San Antonio, Austin, and Dallas as he rolls through the Lone Star State. Houston Chronicle reporting former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg made a three-day run through Texas this week, too. The Texas primaries aren't until March 3rd, but the investment by Democratic presidential candidates in the Lone Star State began considerably earlier. Texas is one of the bigger prizes on Super Tuesday. So who's putting the most time and money into winning over Texas voters, and what are we to make of it? Stephanie Martin is an assistant professor of political communication at SMU in Dallas. One of her areas of expertise is campaign strategy. Stephanie, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
What do you make of Mayor Bloomberg and Pete Buttigieg's current pushes through Texas? What is this telling you?
Well, particularly in Bloomberg's case, he has put all of his eggs in the, let's say, Super Tuesday basket. And so he is making his big push to do something after those early primary states. And so he has spent more in TV ads in the last week than primary field combined, and so he really wants to do something big here. Buttigieg has held off on doing much in Texas, and in the last week has made several visits, and so I think he's seen that he is having a chance in those early primary states and knows that if he has a chance to win the nomination, and you know, a year ago nobody had heard his name and certainly nobody knew how to pronounce it, but he sees that he has a chance to play in the early primary states and knows that if that happens, he needs to be able to continue with that momentum into Texas and beyond.
Forgive me for interrupting. Neither of those two candidates are exactly the top contenders in the Democratic presidential field. What about the investments being made by Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and that sort of top tier?
Yeah, so Biden is in extremely good shape, and Biden looks to... He may well not win any of the first two states. He might not win Iowa or New Hampshire, mm-hmm. although he is right there. But if he comes in and wins South Carolina and he is ahead in Texas, and even I looked at a poll this morning and he's leading in California. So Biden is in extremely good shape. And when he entered last summer, a lot of folks said, hey, Biden's not going to be the nominee. He's so gaffe prone, he won't last. And yet he has sustained, has survived. The few gaffes he's made, hasn't done anything significant. And even with the controversies of the last month with his son, he's still right there. And so I think Biden looks very strong. And Warren had her surge and is, you know, a solid third, if not fourth place sometimes. So it's anybody's ball game at this point. But folks should be very worried about Joe Biden, particularly because his support from people of color has not waned at all. And that is a key Democratic constituency.
Let me ask you about the whole idea of retail politics in the 21st century. I mean, we're talking about Bloomberg and Buttigieg doing sort of the old school thing, getting on a bus and touring Texas. I mean, back in LBJ's days, that was fashionable. But does it work today?
Well, that's what Bloomberg is going to have to do and show that he can do it well, because everybody is talking about Bloomberg's ad buys and that Bloomberg has spent all this money on television. But political science shows that that has very limited returns, right? So probably the people he's going to reach with those television ads that everyone has seen, he's reached the voters, and that has shown he can get 3 to 5% of folks. And the real way that you get primary voters to vote for you is you go out and you shake their hands and you meet them. So if he can't be successful with this bus tour, if he can't get people to come out and meet him and get to know him and want to vote for him, he stands almost no chance. People say he stands no chance anyway, but retail politics are how you win the presidential nomination. That's why those early states count so much. That's what the political science shows, that television ad buys and media ad buys have very limited returns. We have no precedent for the media buys that Michael Bloomberg has done here in the primary. Nobody has spent this kind of money on an ad buy. But retail politics is how you win the presidential primary.
Stephanie Martin is an assistant professor of political communication at SMU. Professor, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard.
I appreciate it very much.
Time to check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, see what Texans are talking about on this Friday. What are you hearing?
Hi, David. Well, we're hearing from folks about that U.S. House resolution reasserting the war powers of Congress. Via Facebook, Brad Emmons says both the Constitution and the past 50 years precedent give the presidency wide latitude militarily. However, Susie Diver asks, were our Texas senators, among the ones encouraging this assassination in return for impeachment votes? She's referring there to this Wall Street Journal story that says after the drone strike, the president told associates he was under pressure to deal with General Soleimani from GOP senators he views as important supporters in his incoming impeachment trial in the Senate. The Wall Street Journal there citing unnamed sources. Interesting stuff. Hearing from several more people about that story, plus other tidbits from social media, if you will. I'll be back with more later in the show.
You know, if we haven't heard from you yet, you know what you need to do is get on one of those social media platforms of your picking and reach out to us. Just look for Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he's going to be back with us in about 35 minutes or so. There's more of The Standard. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Just south of Junction, Texas, among the cacti and the mesquite trees on the banks of the Llano River, sits a house that researchers hope will change the face of conservation. That's a rather tall order. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav explains.
Atmospheric scientist Brian Ansel walks past a small wind turbine, past a beige, double-wide, prefabricated home with solar array, and around the corner to a central piece of his experiment, a 10,000-gallon water tank filled with rainwater.
This is the water tank, so all the rain off the roof goes into pipes that go underground and then up that gray pipe into the top of the tank. Pressure sensor, it sits on the bottom and knows how much water is sitting on top of it. That data goes to the cloud.
He bends over and turns on the spigot of a smaller tank. He and his co-investigators want to change people's conservation behavior and how we live. They'll do it with this spacious 3-bedroom house. Despite a bland exterior, it looks like something you'd find on Airbnb, but it has something none of those houses will have. A smart home system that monitors every drop of water and every watt of electricity and we'll tell you how to use it.
We are engineering a social change.
Social scientist and co-investigator Carol Lindquist says our end-of-the-month water bill isn't enough to influence us. Subjects living here will know exactly how much water they have in their tanks, how much they're using in real time, how much rain is coming, and most importantly, suggestions on how to make the water last. So say no rain is in the forecast, which isn't uncommon in these loamy hills. The system will tell you, hey, run the dishwasher every 3 days instead of every day, and you may need to shower every other day.
And you say, oh man, it's hot. It's summer. It's Texas. I want to shower every day.
So users have to decide, either make the sacrifice or risk running out and getting water from the grid.
So you accept some of the recommendations and reject others. I think that's the key. You don't have to be conserving. You can choose to be conserving.
They'll test the house out on couples for 6 months at a time. They don't expect problems recruiting volunteers to this out-of-the-way field station south of Junction, despite Kimball County being known more for its deer population than its nightlife.
We've had so many people of all ages, retired couples, you know, graduate students and everybody in between, saying, wow, can I apply?
Subjects will do long interviews on how it's going and keep an online journal. The Home Utility Management System, or HUMS, will be improved based on these suggestions. Because what's the point of making a system that people don't want to use, says Ansel.
I think it's first and foremost a test bed, and that's how we tweak things and, you know, make it useful in society. I think our end goal is to get this in the mainstream, and to do that, it would be a commercialization kind of angle.
For too long, they say, the U.S. has relied on massive grids of power and water. When these things go down, it's catastrophic. A third of Texas is in drought right now, during what should be one of its wettest seasons. Droughts are becoming more frequent across the West and globally. Anusha Ajami with Stanford's Wood Center for the Environment says we need to change how we think about water.
It's extremely important the era of mindless consumption is over. And if we don't pay more attention, if we don't try harder to engage people in the process, eventually we'll get to the point that we don't have water.
People are adaptable, she says. They just need the information and the know-how. After 4.5 years, the project hopes to launch this year, but they're low on funds. Texas Tech provided a lump sum, and the team has put in around $30,000 of their own money. Lindquist even spent weeks painting the inside of the house. She says it's worth it, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the long-term possibilities are, oh, they're delicious.
Because they may be able to change how we live and help others impact the world. I'm Paul Flav in Junction, Texas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, this coming Sunday will mark 2 weeks since a gunman killed two people at the West Freeway Church of Christ in White Settlement. That's a northwest suburb of Fort Worth. As KERA's Saida Hassan reports, worshipers have already returned to their regular services.
State officials are not calling the shooting at the West Freeway Church of Christ an act of domestic terrorism, at least not yet. Texas Governor Greg Abbott spoke about the attack earlier this week after a meeting of the state's domestic terrorism task force.
We did talk in this meeting about that shooting and some aspects of it, such as, among other things, the display of it on social media where everybody can see it and the consequences of that.
The church was live streaming its Sunday service, and video footage of the attack was broadcast online. Abbott says it's still being evaluated as a possible act of terror. An official motive in the shooting that killed two people has not been released. The suspect was shot and killed by a member of the church security team. Jack Wilson was an armed volunteer.
I don't see myself as a hero. I see myself as doing what needed to be done to take out the evil threat.
As the investigation continues, the church has resumed its regular services. In fact, worshipers returned to the sanctuary just a day after the shooting for a church-wide meeting. Going back to the scene of a tragedy can help people build mental resilience, says Vale Wright. She's the director of research and special projects at the American Psychological Association.
When approaching a space is safe, like going back to the church, the house of worship, we really encourage people to do that because what it enables you to do is feel like you have some sense of control.
Wright says people tend to think of houses of worship as sanctuaries. When that feeling of security is threatened, the loss of control can be unnerving.
So some people can actually start thinking that no place is safe, when in reality, the whole world is not a dangerous place, but unfortunately, bad things can happen in anywhere and to good people.
Wright says the seemingly endless drumbeat of stories about violent attacks can make people numb. She says there may be a psychological process called habituation at play.
Over time, something that is shocking or stressful or terrible becomes less so because you do start to get kind of used to it. It starts to become your new normal.
Meaning, the more we hear about shootings in public spaces, the less of an impression that news can make.
So even though statistically speaking, these are low probability events, they are happening way too often. And with the way that we consume news and consume information right now and how visual it is, it does feel like it's happening all the time. And so I think that we are just kind of becoming numb to it.
Wright says there can be a number of psychological responses to an attack like this. Some people look for ways to make sense of the situation.
We do things like rationalize, or we seek reassurance from others that everything's going to be okay. We do a lot of compulsive checking on our phones, looking for new information about the situation. And of course, none of these actions actually generally do make us feel better.
Wright encourages people to pay attention to their reactions in the wake of a tragedy like this and explore healthy ways to manage their stress. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
He was born in East Texas, raised in Houston's Fifth Ward, and he became a household name. And not just because he was a heavyweight champion boxer either. Some Texans may remember a certain indoor grill that bore his name. How George Foreman battled his way out of poverty. We'll talk with the author of the first real biography of Foreman on Monday's edition of the Texas Standard. Don't miss it. But wait. Don't touch that dial. There's a whole lot more of the Standard's Friday edition just ahead. In fact, up next, it's the Texas Roundup, a roundup of what's making news across the Lone Star State. So you want to stick around.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A study out this week finds women seeking abortions at clinics in Texas were more likely than women nationwide to have first tried to end the pregnancy on their own. Researchers with the Texas Policy Evaluation Project at the University of Texas at Austin surveyed more than 700 women. 7% tried to perform their own abortion. Lead investigator Dr. Carrie White explains one method women tried.
Many women were using, kind of home remedies like herbs, vitamins, other things. And oftentimes those methods were not successful in ending their pregnancy.
Dr. White says other women obtained the abortion drug misoprostol without a prescription in Mexico. The Trump administration wants to roll back rules requiring comprehensive environmental impact assessments of major infrastructure projects. But as KUT's Mose Bouchel reports, many Texas projects already escape that requirement.
Take the Permian Highway Pipeline project, for example. That's the pipeline that's running through the Texas Hill Country. It is considered an intrastate pipeline. It doesn't cross state boundaries, and so therefore it's not subject to these really strict environmental assessments. In fact, that's a lot of what we're seeing in the battle between local groups, landowners, and the pipeline company Kinder Morgan. Landowners, people opposed to the pipeline, say they want these environmental assessment studies to be done so they have a clear sense of what the impact of the pipeline is going to be. Kinder Morgan says, we don't have to do this because it doesn't fall under federal jurisdiction.
Mose Bouchel reporting. Shrimpers and fishermen in the Rio Grande Valley are challenging a permit a Texas agency granted to one of three proposed liquefied natural gas export terminals in the Brownsville area. They're appealing an air permit and asking the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality to hold what's called a contested case hearing to get public feedback. Aaron Gaines is an attorney for Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid, which is representing the plaintiffs.
At the current permit, it will emit over 8,000 tons per year of air pollutants, not including greenhouse gases, and that will be the largest stationary source of air pollutants in the entire Rio Grande Valley if it's built.
The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which heard oral arguments this week, will decide the future of the permit. And NASA is celebrating its first class of astronauts to graduate under the Artemis program. They'll be eligible for missions to the moon and eventually Mars. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine helped introduce the group this morning during a ceremony at the Johnson Space Center in Houston.
Their trailblazing triumphs will transform humanity's presence in our solar system and forever change life here on Earth. In short, they represent the best of humanity and our most fervent hopes for the future.
The 13 graduates include Laurel O'Hara, who's from the Houston area.
Got to tune to the Texas Standard. Lest anyone miss it, this is a presidential election year, and it's clear that the Trump administration is quite aware of that. In fact, the president has made it clear that he wants to have more of his signature campaign promise realized in concrete before Election Day. You might have heard of the wall. Well, standing in the way is lots of private property down there along the border between Texas and Mexico. But NPR's John Burnett has been reporting that the way the Trump administration is trying to work around this obstacle has many conservationists and folks in South Texas quite upset. Good to see you again, John.
Sure. It's always good to be here, David.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about something that has been described as a string of pearls.
Mm-hmm.
What is this string of pearls that you're telling us about?
So from Falcon Dam down in South Texas all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, almost 300 miles, there is a network of nature refuges that was created over the past 40 years by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They've spent almost $80 million buying up 135 different properties. They've assembled what they call a string of pearls as a corridor for wildlife, for bobcats and the endangered little spotted cat, the ocelot, deer, all the wild things that need to go back and forth to drink in the river.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is a project that's like 40 years in the making, right?
Exactly. But this is kind of the low-hanging fruit for Customs and Border Protection. So when they looked to build Trump's wall down on the border, The first property they went to was federal land. This is Betty Perez, who is a longtime rancher in South Texas and a member of the Friends of the Wildlife Corridor, which opposes the wall.
The fish and wildlife land is what's being targeted first because it's easy. You know, it's the first thing you can get to without having to worry about all the process of buying land from people.
Now, wait a minute. I thought this was federally protected land.
It is protected land, but Homeland Security has waived 31 different environmental and cultural protection laws to do whatever they want on it. And so they're planning to build through 18 miles of this wildlife refuge. It's 14 square miles of property that could be affected by the wall that they had set aside for decades for the wild critters down there.
You say this wildlife refuge. Which wildlife refuge?
Well, it's the string of pearls. It's all of it.
All of it.
That's right. And you need it all to be a viable wildlife refuge.
Why is that? Could you explain what's going on there?
Well,
these are not contiguous, right?
They're not contiguous because the Rio Grande Valley, as you know, David, has been highly developed in modern times. It's been paved over for shopping centers and housing developments. It's been plowed up for cotton fields and grapefruit orchards. Mm-hmm. And so there's less than 5% of the native habitat bought. U.S. Fish and Wildlife has been buying up farmland, revegetating it, turning it back into natural habitat, and then creating this string of habitats to try to help the wildlife.
So now we have actual construction that's taking place.
It's going on now.
Is anyone trying to stop it?
Well, they don't really have any recourse. But interestingly, I spoke with Henry Cuellar, the Democratic congressman from Laredo. He's the one who inserted language in the appropriations bill that said, hey, wall builders, you can't build in the Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge.
Mm-hmm.
You can't build in the National Butterfly Center. You can't build in Benson State Park. And I interviewed him last week, and he said he had a map of the refuge system on the table in front of him and was realizing for the first time that, hey, there's a lot of other good stuff that is important for the functioning of the wildlife corridor. We may have to carve out some more protected areas and tell them they can't build the wall there.
You know, I remember a lot of these issues coming up many, many years ago, back during the Bush administration, if I'm not mistaken, after 9/11, right? They tried to put up some construction down in South Texas.
Well, they actually did. I mean, George Bush put up 55 miles of fence down there. And at the time, the manager of the whole South Texas Wildlife Refuge for Fish and Wildlife complained about it. And he wrote a report that said, this is an inappropriate use of this property. That was Ken Merritt, who since retired.
Back then, and I don't think it's any different than now, we had a very narrow refuge. And when it's so narrow, basically, if you cut that in half with a fence that really can't be accessed or crossed by terrestrial wildlife, you have a big problem.
If you put that fence up and there's flooding down there, I mean, they have hurricanes that go through the Rio Grande Valley and the river comes way up. And there was anecdotally an event in 2012 in which the water rose, the critters could not get out and drowned. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife confirmed to NPR that's exactly what they're worried about.
This is some very important and interesting reporting that John Burnett is doing. He's an NPR correspondent based in Austin, but he's been down at the border spending considerable time watching the Trump administration try to erect its wall in these wildlife areas. John, good to see you, sir. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Happy to be here.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org.
This is the Texas Standard. My name is Andrew Lanham, and I'm the co-writer along with Destin Daniel Cretton of the film Just Mercy, which is an adaptation of Bryan Stevenson's nonfiction book.
The first time I visited death row, I wasn't expecting to meet somebody the same age as me.
I went to the University of Texas, Austin for my MFA in screenwriting, and I also won the Austin Film Festival Drama and their Independent Screenplay Award in 2010, which was really kind of my door opening into the industry, which led to my representation and kind of further work. It's a real honor and kind of thrill while being slightly surreal at the same time to be back here with an actual big movie.
It is ordered, adjudged, and decreed that Walter McMillan is to face death by electrocution.
Bryan Stevenson is this amazing and inspiring individual who's one of the leading, if not the leading, anti-death penalty and civil rights lawyers in the country. And he runs the Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama, which is working for not only death row inmates, but children and other people who have kind of been taken advantage of by our system in order to try to kind of push along social change in this country. And he wrote a number of years ago a nonfiction book that half of which is the story of Walter McMillan, which is one of the first wrongfully accused men on death row who he represented and tried to set free, played by Jamie Foxx.
They convicted an innocent man. I was always taught to fight for the people who need the help the most.
Most times when you adapt something, you kind of ask yourself, how can I bring my voice to this particular story? But it was much more a process of putting my own voice aside and trying to educate myself as much as possible to kind of live up to the opportunity of working on a project like this.
I don't want my son growing up knowing his mom stopped doing what was right just because she was scared.
I think one of the amazing things about the way that Bryan Stevenson imparts his message is that he fills it with hope, even though the situation can often feel hopeless. It's all too easy to become kind of bitter and jaded when fighting for change in the world of today. And Bryan never lets that enter his spirit or his vocabulary. And I think that's such a beautiful, inspiring thing that I've watched it happen. It opens up closed minds, which is so hard to do.
Your life is still meaningful. And I'm gonna do everything possible to keep them from taking it.
Just Mercy opens in select theaters on December 25th, and then nationwide it goes into full release on January 10th. My name is Andrew Lanham, and I am the co-writer of Just Mercy with the director, Destin Daniel Cretton, based on the nonfiction book by Brian Stevenson, and this is the Texas Standard.
Minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Dallas's 10th Street community is a small neighborhood just south of downtown, which earned a designation as an historic district back in the 90s. Today it is dotted with empty lots and homes, and according to the National Trust for Historic Preservation, it is one of America's most endangered historic places. Many attempts have been made over the years to revitalize this historically black community, but none have worked, and KERA's Miguel Perez has been looking into why.
It's been more than 60 years since Patricia Cox's home has gotten any serious repairs.
I need repiping, but some of the other homes might need a new roof or some need new flooring.
The houses here have good bones, Cox says, but many have endured decades of neglect. Now, 10th Street was founded by freed slaves after the Civil War, and it quickly grew into a thriving community. Dallas mostly forgot about it, though, until 1993, when the city made it a historic district. Now, that designation was meant to protect 10th Street, but Cox says the city has done little to help residents preserve their homes.
It's not gonna be an arm and a leg to redo some of the homes, you know. It's just a matter of wanting to. But the city saw fit to cut us off.
Residents say a 2010 ordinance contributed to 10th Street's decline by letting the city raise historic but neglected structures that are smaller than 3,000 square feet. And dozens of homes have been demolished since then. Residents sued the city in response. They say that rule discriminated against 10th Street's poorer minority residents compared to the wealthier white residents in other historic districts. The Dallas City Council, hoping to undo decades of inaction, came one step closer to a solution this past August when they voted to stop demolitions. Some council members, like Lee Kleinman, expressed concern over what to do next.
10th Street, if there are properties there that are really beyond salvaging, we're just going to have to watch them continue to blight until we can either get the owners to improve them, or if the city owns it, I'm not sure what we're supposed to do.
In the meantime, the neighborhood's status as a landmark helps keep out overzealous developers by limiting what can be built in the area.
If it's taken away, anything can be built in the neighborhood.
That's Jorge Caso, an attorney with Legal Aid of Northwest Texas, which is representing residents.
There's a lot of development going in and around the area, so if, you know, bigger homes are constructed, there's a potential danger for current residents to be displaced.
Norman Alston, a Dallas architect who specializes in historic preservation, says the responsibility of maintaining historic homes may deter some homeowners.
You know, we're geared for new construction here. A lot of folks aren't comfortable fixing what's there. That the easier just do it new.
But Alston says the designation keeps the old houses in place, and with it, the spirit of the neighborhood.
There has to be a better way than just scraping them, because that takes just a little bit of a community soul every time that happens.
Resident Patricia Cox agrees.
We need to refurbish the homes that we have standing, not tear them down. Either you repair your home or you sell it.
Preserving these old houses can be a challenge for many of the neighborhood's poorer residents. Another issue, houses here are so old that many were passed on without wills. These so-called heirship properties are instead divvied up among surviving descendants. That can shut residents out of funding assistance programs that require proof of ownership. Caso says inherited properties also make it hard for buyers to find owners and clear a home's title.
Since a lot of these titles are so clouded, a lot of developers won't want to buy into 10th Street because it's so difficult. So it's, in a way, it's a double-edged sword. It harms the neighborhood because residents can't tap into certain resources, but it's also protecting it from the various pressures from the outside.
And so 10th Street teeters on that double-edged sword, paralyzed in place with no support. Whatever path 10th Street takes moving forward, residents like Patricia Cox say the history has to be preserved.
I don't want it to be a museum, but I do want it to be known that we were established in the 1800s and that we're still standing.
But 10th Street might not be standing for much longer if no one comes up with a solution soon. I'm Miguel Perez in Dallas.
Well, sixth-ranked Baylor University ended one of the longest winning streaks in women's basketball history last night in Connecticut. Not their own streak, mind you. The Lady Bears defeated number one-ranked UConn 74-58, smashing the Huskies' winning streak of 98 consecutive home game wins. UConn's women's team hadn't dropped a home game since March 12, 2013. ESPN says Thursday's win will likely push Baylor's women's basketball team to number one, which seems awfully proper since they are the defending national champions, after all. Coming up on 49 Minutes Past the Hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
I'm Sean Petrie. I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. In the Typewriter Rodeo, we make up poems on the spot on whatever topic people want. More meetings. We had one on Tuesday and Wednesday morning, and now it looks like another is forming. A meeting to discuss what we're doing next month, which we just did last week. Isn't once enough? It seems like we have them just so Jim gets to speak and tell his jokes, the same ones, on repeat. Maybe if we stuck to a semi-strict order or actually followed the agenda, they'd be so much shorter. But they drag on. There's too many. I don't mean to sound like a jerk, but maybe if we didn't meet so much, we could, I don't know, work?
For the Texas Standard, I'm Sean Petrie with the Typewriter Rodeo.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Typewriter Rodeo does everything by analog, but you don't have to. You can email us your ideas and we'll get them over to the rodeo. Got an idea? We're waiting to hear from you. Texas Standard at KUT.org. Well, we've made it to Friday, and that means it's time again to check in on the week that was in Texas politics with the Texas Tribune. And the Trib's Alex Samuels joins us now. Happy Friday, Alex.
Yes, happy Friday.
All right, so Governor Abbott continues to come down on Austin's homeless ordinances. He's pointing to another stabbing. What does he want the city to do when it comes to the homeless situation, and what's he saying he might do in the meantime?
Yeah, so on Thursday, he ordered the Department of Public Safety to increase patrols both in downtown Austin and around the UT Austin campus in the wake of these two recent stabbings that involved people who were homeless.
Tell us a little bit more about those situations. I mean, I'm thinking that some people may not be aware of those two stabbings.
Right. So the first happened last Friday in Austin, a little bit south of downtown. A man, Dylan Woodburn, who's 27, allegedly attacked two workers in a Freebirds restaurant, and he killed one of the store managers there. The governor also listed in his letter to the DPS another incident that happened Wednesday morning between two people experiencing homelessness in downtown Austin, which ended with both parties and seriously injured.
So how are Austin officials responding to this latest volley from the governor?
So the mayor, Austin Mayor Steve Adler, has previously accused Abbott of demonizing homeless people. And instead of increasing patrols, he's asked the governor to better fund services for the vulnerable, which includes, you know, mental health clinics, substance abuse treatment, and housing.
Some presidential politics news. We know Texan Julian Castro dropped out of the race and quickly threw his support to Senator Elizabeth Warren. What about his supporters? Are they following suit?
Yes. So it's interesting. A lot of Castro supporters actually so far have gone to Joe Biden. Biden released his list of endorsers. I believe there were eight people who had previously been with Castro are now on Biden's campaign. That includes five state representatives and members of the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus. So it's interesting to see that these folks are going to Biden's campaign, even though the person they supported, Castro, is now supporting Warren.
Their former boss. Speaking of Elizabeth Warren, something new from you on the Tribune site today. She's picked up some new Texas endorsements, I gather?
Yes. So she had 20 new endorsements total. Let me caveat that with saying a few of them had been previously announced. State Representatives Aaron Zwiener and Sean Theory both had previously endorsed Warren. So I guess there are a total of 18 new names. And this is sort of one of the biggest endorsement lists Warren has announced since she's put an increased focus on Texas here.
You think this is moving the needle at all when it comes to actual political outcomes here in the Lone Star State?
Warren definitely has her work cut out for her. She's overshadowed in the race for Texas endorsements by Biden. And in the latest University of Texas, Texas Tribune poll, she came in second to Biden. So she still has her work cut out for her. I guess what's working to her advantage is she now has a potentially powerful Texas ally in Castro, who appeared with her at an event in Brooklyn earlier this week and plans to campaign with Warren throughout the weekend.
Alex Samuels, political reporter for the Texas Tribune, texastribune.org. Alex, great to talk with you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Okay, let's check in one more time with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Friday, you got that Friday feeling?
I have that Friday feeling in spades. Mm-hmm. Well, I think as you're alluding to, it's been kind of a rough first week back for many after the holiday break with all the whiplash news, developments, and whatnot. So let's, end the week on a lighter note with some responses to a fun question that's going viral
that
online. Twitter user Styled by Ratty, she set the Twitterverse afire with this simple question: what's the dumbest thing you ever got in trouble for at school?
The dumbest thing
you ever got in trouble for at school. Retweets and responsive have reached into the tens of thousands, and so we directed her question to our friends and listeners, and boy, have we gotten a fun range of responses here. Chris Hammack on the dumbest thing that ever got him in trouble. He says, a substitute teacher got mad at me for not eating one of the donuts he brought in for the class. That's an interesting one. Drew Landry says, I wore a kilt to school and was sent home to change. Classic of the genre there. I feel like I've heard this one before from other folks as well. Ashby says, I brought my new skateboard to school and got sent home for promoting Satanism, LOL. He included a picture of this board, and it's like this like scary looking Frankenstein face.
That's classic.
Roskop skateboard for all you old heads out there. More serious responses as well. Ignacio Martinez, he writes that he made an off-kilter joke about our high school's vice principal being weirdly touchy with female students, but he says that an investigation was launched and he later resigned that same year.
Wow.
Yeah, nice. Strange stuff. And then at the college level, Sky Stevens, she tweets, the professor of my college literature course got really mad at me when I flipped through the textbook to look at pictures of authors while he was going over the syllabus. I was still listening to him, but he treated me like dirt the rest of the semester. It was crushing. So a real range of responses there, and I don't know. It raises some interesting questions. I was trying to think about what my
what
response would be,
but
I feel like every time I got in trouble is pretty well deserved. So I can't really.
I had quite a few dumb ones, but I'm just not going to go there. I can't. I just can't.
Yeah, we don't have enough time.
No,
here.
Not at all. In fact, we should mention something that's rather important.
Yep.
I think something that Texas Monthly and some other folks are warning Texans about: batting down the hatches.
Oh yeah.
Because we got some storms and some nasty weather en route to Texas. The NOAA, NOAA Storm Prediction Center, has put pretty much all of the eastern half of the state under a severe weather warning today. Big swath of East Texas, including parts of Longview, at a moderate risk for some serious storms. Austin, Houston, Dallas, and Fort Worth metro areas facing an enhanced risk. So be on the lookout. Park that car under some kind of shelter if you can. And of course, keep it right here for the very latest on the weather. And stay safe, would you? We're out of time for the big broadcast. We'll be back here on Monday, and we hope you can join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the crew, wishing you a wonderful weekend.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.